Good afternoon and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As we usually tell you about this time, this conversation includes you if you'd like to join us. The phone lines are open at 941-3689. If you call from Oahu, that's the number, 941-3689. And from the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream someplace else and you'd like to join us, talk to us at 877-941-3689. 10 years ago, then-President George Bush made history by establishing the Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. Shortly before he left office, he also created the Pacific Remote Islands Marine National Monument. It's actually a group of protected reserves, including Papahanaumokuakea. In 2014, President Obama expanded the Pacific Remote Islands Marine National Monument and more recently announced his intention to greatly increase the size of Papahanaumokuakea. While conservationists support the idea, it has not been well received by the commercial fishing industry, nor have Hawaii lawmakers taken to the plan. Last month, many, including Senate President Cauchy and House Speaker Suki, sent a letter to the president asking him to forego the expansion. For his part, Governor Ige remained open to the possibility if concerns of the opposition could be addressed, which is what Senator Brian Schott sought to do in a recent visit and his resulting proposal to the president. So what do both conservationists who like the original idea and the fishermen who opposed it say about this latest version? We're going to find out tonight and also what you think about it. Tonight, we're going to speak with Sean Martin. He is the president of the Hawaii Long Line Association. He says that even in the most recent version that he and his constituents are not really part of that. And William Isla Jr. joins us. He is a deputy to the chairperson of the Department of Hawaiian Homelands. And you'll remember he's the former chairperson of the Department and Board of Land and Natural Resources. He helped create the Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument. And, of course, you're here, too. Again, our numbers, 941-3689 from Oahu and from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. Thank you both for making time.
Thank you.
Aloha. Especially on a day when a lot of people are thinking very far away, well over just the pond. But in looking at what may happen in our very large pond with both the Marine National Monument and some of the great discussion that we've had around this, I think it might be helpful to go back a little bit and talk about how this monument was originally created, of something that was done, as mentioned in the opening, by President George Bush, but not with a great deal of conversation that happened back here in Hawaii. William Isla Jr., you remember those days.
Sure. And
Beth, what happened with that?
Well, Beth, if I could take you back a little bit further. I mean, in the year 2000, then-President Bill Clinton, through an executive order using the Antiquities Act, created the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands Coral Reef Ecosystem Reserve, which I guess provided the basis and the studies and the accumulation of information, which later led to, I believe, the decision-making process for President Bush. At that time, the Coral Reef Ecosystem Reserve was in the process of transforming itself into a National Marine Sanctuary. The story that I've been told is that President Bush, sitting with his wife and some folks, one of the custos, watching a film, was either inspired himself or his wife was inspired to inspire him, and turned to some staff and said, well, you know, this is taking too long. Why don't we just create a monument and give me something in 72 hours to sign? And so that is the story that I have been told by many independent folks, some of them who were there, as to how the creation actually of the monument actually came about.
It's a great story. But the fact is still that there wasn't any time, even if, in 72 hours, to have any conversation here, which certainly didn't do anything for some of the issues that we see having bubbled up through incarnation.
I think you could safely say there was minimum conversation back here in Hawaii with the state and with folks back here in the place most impacted. One of the fallouts from that decision was the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, who was, throughout that the monuments, the sanctuary process, was looking to be included as a co-trustee of what eventually became the monument. So the proposal that's put forward by Senator Schatz right now includes the elevation of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs to a co-trustee position.
As we look at this situation happening in, you know, circa 2000, and then what happens moving from sanctuary to becoming a monument, were there any conversations along the way that included your constituents, Sean?
Well, if I can go back even a little bit further than William.
Okay, let's go back even further.
Even further. The original regulations that took into account some of the protected species that were up in the Northwest Hawaiian Islands raised some concern, and the Fishery Council actually made a protected species prohibited zone. So they actually prohibited longline fishing prior to Bill Clinton initiating the sanctuary process. So with some minor modifications, the zone that we currently have, which is a 100 miles wide, 50 miles from each point of land, is actually was a product of the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council and their initiatives to take into consideration some of the special considerations of that particular area. So that goes back even a little bit further than President Clinton's initiatives. But we really weren't involved in President Clinton's discussions to any significant way, but we were very much involved in the process, the council process that initially made those closed areas. So we have been very active in that area for a long time, and were initially engaged. And as it kind of progressed, we were less and less engaged, I guess you'd say.
It seems in both cases, though, that at least with the going back to those years, prior to 2000 and in the early parts of the discussion moving from sanctuary to monument, that there were a lot of holes and gaps. Is that one of the reasons why you think that we're having such discussions now and why this is becoming more of an issue to be involved in this discussion?
Well, I would say that the amount of information that we have today, the complexity of ecosystems, the consideration of threatened and endangered species is probably why we're having, you know, this more complex proposal being put forward. The council action that Sean refers to was actually as a result of, a highly endangered monk seal being hooked by some longline fishermen, which got the discussion going under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and then eventually the Western Pacific Fisheries Management Council created this protective zone. So as we get more information about what's out there, what's under the water, what are the consequences with climate change, global warming, these kinds of things, it causes us to look at things through a new lens Sean would say more drastic rules.
Oh, Sean will talk for himself.
Yeah, okay. Well, he will. and we would say, well, you know, the world is a more complex place. That's why we need stricter rules. So.
All right. Well, we've got a lot of callers who have decided to join us very early. If you would like to also be part of this conversation, we're taking a look at what the latest plan or the latest proposal from Senator Brian Schatz means for Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Sanctuary, Monument, and what that means for those who would potentially engage with it or be, you know, prohibited from doing that. 941-3689 is our number, or 877-941-3689. Going to Jim, calling us from Kaneohe. Aloha, Jim. Welcome
to
Town
Aloha.
Square. Hi there.
So I have a question for Bill. You know, NOAA is in charge of approving and enforcing sustainable fisheries in Hawaii. We're wondering why Senator Schatz would advocate removing one of our few food sources from us. Does he think NOAA is a failure? Shouldn't our citizens be able to enjoy sustainable fish locally produced? Thank you.
Hey, Jim. Thank you for that question. And similar to Beth's response to me. It's hard for me to speak to what's in Brian's, Senator Schatz's mind. I would, you know, answer your question, I think, in the way that my previous statement was, that the world is a much more complex place today with climate change. We know that things are different, and the old solutions to problems in the past required new solutions, such as on our side, larger marine protected areas that are inclusive of the maximum amount of protection.
From a lot of what we heard during his visit was that he was trying to come up with some sort of conciliatory position in some ways in talking to stakeholders and constituents. Do you feel that he did a really accurate job in representing what you feel you have to either gain or lose at this, Sean?
No, I don't. In Senator Schatz's letter to the president, he did make mention of the recognition that the Hawaii fishery is really a model fishery around the world in many of the things that we do. We're very active in developing and implementing mitigation measures having to do with interactions with protected species. Many of those initiatives have been now expanded around the world. And so the senator did make recognition of that in his letter, but then it went silent. And so when he was in the letter that I saw to the president, he did recognize the concerns of the small boat fishermen for Kauai and Niihau. Certainly, I think that was an appropriate approach. They are a very important fishery for their communities. But there wasn't any recognition further than an acknowledgement of how the Hawaii fishery operates. There wasn't any mention of anything further than that.
So you were excluded. I mean, sustenance is one thing, but not commercial fishing.
That's correct. Not commercial longline fishing, but the small boat fisheries that were addressed from Niihau and Kauai are commercial fisheries. And they're both troll fisheries, and they're fisheries that bottom fish as well. So whereas they may have impacts to resources on the ocean bottom, the longline fishery and the troll fisheries, they don't interact with the bottom at all, especially in the existing areas that we operate in today.
Well, a lot of people want to be talking to both of you. I'm watching the phone lines just light up over on the other side there. We're going to go now to Dean calling us from Pearl City. And if you'd like to be next, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Should the Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument be expanded? That's what we're talking about today. William Isla is here and Sean Martin. And you too. Going now to Dean in Pearl City. Aloha, Dean. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, hey, Sean. This is for Sean Martin. They're saying that if they expand this monument, they're looking at having you guys lose about 8% of the fish that you guys catch. Now, why is the Longline Association getting all worked up about this, what seems like a small percentage of their total catch?
Well, all right, Dean. Thanks very much for the question.
Thanks for the question, Dean. I guess I would flip the question back to you and say if I went to you and said that I was going to take 8% of your paycheck and do something different with it, not for any reason other than I could, and maybe you had to go and reallocate your energy to make up for that 8% of the paycheck that I took, what would you think? I mean, it's 8% is a number that is batted around, and that number is not a given number in any given year, and so I think it's important that there's a recognition that sometimes that 8% could be 30%. These are very productive grounds at certain times in certain years, and so being able to explore these waters as we have traditionally are very important to the overall health of the fishery.
There have been suggestions that the money really isn't so much the issue, although clearly having people have big cuts in, or not big, but whatever it may be of their paycheck wouldn't be a welcome situation, but that this is more a matter of federal government intrusion?
Well, yes. I agree that I do believe that the federal government is intruding. And it's one thing to intrude for a benefit, and I guess maybe William would feel differently, but from the science that we look at, the benefits from conservation or sustainability are negligible. So if we're doing this, and I think that there's a common belief that this is something that President Obama is considering as he winds up his two terms in office, I'm not so much inclined to believe that President Obama's legacy is more important than what it means to the people of the state of Hawaii. So it's troubling that that we're doing this in large part for a legacy for a president, not unlike the two previous presidents.
That brings up an interesting point to this, that are we really looking at this through a lens that might mitigate the situation better for both perspectives, yours and Longline Fisher folk? Or is this really being driven simply by a president who's going to do what he's going to do anyway and making it subject to just his own political will?
Well, the action was initiated by Native Hawaiians in the state of Hawaii, who is actually put forth a request to the president of the United States to consider this. As Sean stated earlier, the estimates of how much catch or how much effort in this current area that would be excluded range from 5 to 8%. So that means that 92 or 95% of the current effort is already occurring outside of this effort. So there is, according to NOAA data, there is a already movement towards fishing outside of the exclusive economic zone in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. Will that likely result in any reduction of fish in the state of Hawaii? That remains to be seen. We already import a lot of less quality tuna into the state of Hawaii because much of the longline fish, some is sold locally, but quite a bit of it leaves the state of Hawaii and goes to California or other countries. So the net benefit to the present group of the people of Hawaii, that's questionable. I think the conversation, though, is that these fish belong to everyone, not just the longline fleet. They belong to the future generation. So from a large marine protected area being more resilient and more sustainable, if you come at it from that angle, then the questions are much different than the conversation we're having right now.
So in that conversation that you would like to have, that would seem to be the argument to not be having this rushed by a president who wants to leave a legacy.
I think with the rapid change in world conditions, it is the reason that we asked this president to take a look at this change.
Even so, I mean, this has taken, 2 years to be able to move this conversation along?
Actually, this conversation started, I believe, with the letter that we wrote sometime in November of last year. So it's only been 8 months.
But in 2014, didn't he say that he wanted to expand?
That may have been referring to the Pacific Island, remote island areas, because...
But, I mean, this has been on his mind for a while.
It could have been. I'm not aware of that.
We've got lots of callers on the phone who would like to be talking to you about all kinds of things. If you would like to join us, the number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We're going to go to Kinau calling us from Kaneohe. Thank you for your patience.
Hi. My question is for Mr. Aila. Do you know how much of the fish caught in Hawaii, inclusive of Papahanaumo Kuakea, by our longline fishing fleet, stays in Hawaii? The reason why I'm asking is because as a local, I go to the local fish markets, the local supermarkets, and I have a choice to make. I have a choice to make when I'm buying poke to buy the $15 a pound fish that's local and fresh, or the treated fish, the ones that are treated with carbon monoxide. And this is something that I have to reconcile with. So if you could answer my question again, how much of the fish caught in Hawaii by our longline fishing fleet stays in Hawaii?
Sure. And many people will give you different answers. I can only go by what I heard in testimony before the Office of Hawaiian Affairs by Mr. Goto, who sits on the International Tuna Treaty Organization for the Central North Pacific Stock, and is, you know, a relative and closely related to the family that runs the United Fishing Agency auction block. And his testimony before the Office of Hawaiian Affairs was somewhere less than 50%. So I go back to it's nice that we have some fresh fish here in Hawaii, but the argument that this is going to remove all the fresh fish here in Hawaii is moot, because we already have a net reduction in fish because the higher quality tuna, in some cases, almost 50%, according to that person, is already exported out of Hawaii.
Sean, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I would. And I know that William mentioned this is a previous meeting that we were at together, and so I actually did some research. And there is, to the best of my knowledge, NOAA is the authority on doing the kind of research that addresses this. In this case, it's social economic research. And in a conclusion of a paper that I can refer somebody to if they wish. 80% stays in Hawaii. 18% is exported to the U.S. mainland, and less than 2% is exported. So I know I hear this that it's not really for the state of Hawaii, but that's not what the report says. And this was a peer-reviewed, you know, scientific document. So so I do think that there is a very important component that contributes to the Hawaii economy. And and I think that tails into the discussion of people that are concerned about the proposed expansion and what it might mean. And there's a Fishing Means Food website that I would refer people to that will be available to get some of the information that they feel might be useful in this. And there's a broad concern by community leaders from Roy of Roy's Restaurant and Dean from Nala Farms, as well as other community leaders and business leaders who are very concerned about what the long-term impacts of this might have on the people of Hawaii and also the economy.
As very similar to Sean, I mean, the folks in my camp are very much interested in the long-term sustainability. So from our point of view, in putting aside, you know, 5 to 8% of the potential catch of this area, as an insurance policy against climate change and reports of certain stocks of fish declining, it's a small price to pay for our grandchildren and great grandchildren, and you know our logic and our science can be found at, you know, www.expandpmnm. So
hearing both of you and having had other discussions where it's a case of, well, is my science better than your science, or whose report is being used to thwart whose, you know, data in this, it leaves a lot of people in the center very, very confused and wondering what to do. I mean, few people would argue, and I'm sure, Sean, you wouldn't argue with the idea that we want to make sure that we have as viable an ocean for grandchildren and great-grandchildren as William just said. I mean, we hear that argument a lot, too. It's the how and the doing of it where we seem to have some real problems. Do you think there's a point where there can be greater confluence of both your objectives, Sean Martin, and yours, William Isla?
I think there certainly can be discussion, but the very distinct points of view on the effectiveness of this proposal is one of, you know, what is the effect on my family today if I'm not allowed to fish and, you know, 8%, as Sean said, 8% of his income is removed versus the perspective that we're coming from. Well, what's the harm in putting 8% of everyone's fish stock, because it's a public trust resource that is owned by everyone, in a little insurance account for future generations, just in case.
So, I mean, this is sounding like an argument of, you know, short-term gain and long-term loss.
Well,
I think
it's a much bigger picture than that. I think that the way that the industry, the longline and commercial fishing industries, look at it is the existing monument does take into account many of the things that I'm sure that William's folks, William and people that he works with, are concerned about, having to do with coral reefs and nearshore fisheries. I think from a commercial fishing offshore standpoint, which is what the longline fishery is, we take the approach that this area is important, but so is the entire ocean. So our fisheries are actually managed through a public process that takes into account all kinds of different impacts on the ocean, the climate, and manages the fishery in a public process, but it's throughout its range. So our boats that are in the Hawaii longline fishery are actually managed throughout their range, and their range is quite broad. So we take very seriously the idea that the entire ocean is important, and managing throughout the range of the fish. These are pelagic fish who maybe move thousands of miles in the course of a year. And so it's important that management takes that into account. So it's not a specific area, it's a broad range area, and that's the approach that the Hawaii longline fishery takes.
Did you want to add something to that before we go to more calls?
Sure. Sean is here because his interest is fishing, but the expansion of Papahanaumoku Akea goes beyond fishing. What we're advocating the president to do is to create this monument that prohibits deep sea mining, that creates very specific and long time protection for maritime cultural artifacts. So you have to the north of Midway, just north of Kure, you have an important battle being fought there with the Battle of Midway. And there are three Japanese aircraft carriers and one American aircraft carrier, the Yorktown, that have been identified within the proposed area of protection. So for us, it's not just a question of fishing. It's a question of protecting the ocean bottom from ocean mining. It's protecting the cultural resources, the maritime cultural resources. It's protecting the oldest living organism known to man on the planet, that's more than 4,000 year old, a recently discovered black coral, the largest sponge discovered in the world, the size of a minivan, on seamounts surrounding the existing protected area. And this is calling for the larger expansion for protection. So it's not just about fishing.
All right, we're going to take some more calls then. Continue on with the conversation. If you'd like to join us, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Stephanie calling us from Mililani. Aloha, Stephanie. Thanks for your patience.
Hi, thank you. I have a question for Mr. Ayla. Your title is Deputy Director of Hawaiian Homelands, which is a paid state position. Do you represent them in your official capacity on this issue?
No. In fact, that's how I was recognized in this case. Part of the interest in the expansion of Papahanaumoku Akea actually started with the effort to bring President Obama to the World Conservation Congress in September, and trying to create something that is worthy of him to come and announce at the World Conservation Congress, which would elevate that event to a much higher scale. So that was part of my charge as part of the host committee way back when. Now, do I have a personal interest in seeing that the area is protected for, you know, my descendants? Yes, of course I do.
Stephanie, thanks very much for your question. Going to go now to Paul calling us from downtown. Aloha, Paul. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi. This is for Bill. Bill,
could you do me a favor and turn down? Hang on a second. Port. Hang on a second. Could you please just turn down? Did we lose him?
No, I'm still here.
Okay, you're still there. Good. Could make sure you turn down your radio because we're getting a lot of backfeed.
Okay. Is that okay now?
Okay, I don't know where we seem to be having a problem with the phone line. We have two lines coming in at once. We're going to try to get Paul back. Paul, are you there? Did we lose him? Okay, sorry, Paul. Do us a favor and just call right back. And apologies for the phone lines, which seem to be acting screwy today. We're going to go on now and talk to Joni, calling us from Kaneohe. Aloha, Joni.
Aloha. Hi. I had a question for Bill Isla. I was reading some of the old the meeting minutes from the original Hanaumokuakea monument, and I read in there how some people said it's not about the science. So I wonder, how are we going to manage that area if some people are on the stance that we don't believe in science? Because I really feel that science is going to help us to understand the greater issue on how to care for it.
I think your question actually relates to how do you determine between the different science that's being put forward.
Yeah, whose science, going back to that question, whose science is better
right,
than whose science?
Right. So whose science are you inclined to accept and then act on? So I'm not sure, you know, what minutes you're referring to, but I do know that there are some people out there who on both sides feel that emotionally they have an attachment to their position. And so they have less of an attraction for science, and that's just human nature.
Sean, anything that you want to comment, or can
well,
we move on?
Well, no, I'd just like to contribute that I think that probably it's not disputable that NOAA provides most of the validated science for the area, and so and that's what the current area is managed under. Outside of the existing monument boundary, but inside of the EEZ boundary. And so NOAA has responsibilities to address the science through a number of statutes that they have to engage in when they develop management policies. And so NOAA Fisheries and the NOAA Science Center certainly has the longest history of providing the science for up in that area. And so one of the concerns that we have is that, and a question that I would pose is does anybody believe that NOAA has failed in their efforts to properly manage the fishery based upon Magnuson-Stevens Act and the other statutes that they're required to adhere to? So I do think that, and as William points out, you people tend to read science in different ways depending on their position.
And we know that people will often go and look for positions that agree with them, and
sure,
we hear that from social science.
Yes.
So that's not a surprise.
And I would just add, you know, the Science Center does a lot of good work, but occasionally they do make mistakes. In the past, they've advised the Western Pacific Fisheries Management Council to allow for the removal of undersized and buried lobsters, and that resulted in a zero quota being set for the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. Recently, there's been, you know, mathematical models that get put forward by the Science Center, and then they find all of a sudden, oops, you know, something may be wrong with that model. And unfortunately, management decisions get made based upon mathematical models that get put forward by the science. So there is no absolute science, I think, on either side in this case. But there is certainly, I think, our perspective is it doesn't hurt to err on the side of caution.
All right. Well, we're going to hopefully hear what Paul has to say. Paul called us back. Paul, are you there from downtown?
Yes, I'm back again.
Oh, good. Much better. Thank you. Go ahead.
Hi. I was going to ask you, William. William, the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands closure in 1991 meant that there's been no monk seals taken by the longline fishery since then. The green sea turtle population has recovered, has rebounded. Also, that the longline fishery, as I'm sure you'll remember, has reduced its sea turtle interaction rate by 90%, seabirds about the same, seabird populations on the in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands are stable. Even the false killer whale populations, though they're small, they're insular populations. They don't range much out beyond the 50 nautical miles. So I'm curious as to why protected species are being pushed so hard when this expansion will, in my opinion, have very little impact on those protected species.
Well, I would turn that around on you, Paul, by stating that having an expansion that impacts, you know, 5 to 8% of the effort in that area is not going to have a detrimental. It'll actually have a better impact on the good work that's being done by the longline fishery right now. And, you know, those fisheries management measures that were put into place by Westpac, you know, based upon some court cases and at some direction of the U.S. District Court, excuse me, is an indication that we have to always be cognizant of changing situations, and therefore, it's always better to be on the safe side. And so for 5 to 8%, we're going to disagree on that number. For that amount of fish effort that could be done in other areas outside of the EEZ, outside of the main Hawaiian Islands closed areas, it is, in our opinion, a small price to pay. I can see in the opinion of people who are going to displace, it's a big price to pay. But once again, I remind you that these resources don't belong just to longline fishermen. They belong to all of the people of the United States, including future generations.
Paul, thanks very much.
Thank you very much for the chance to pose a question.
Okay, did you have a follow-up?
Well, I was just curious, Bill's comment that they belong to everybody, then why would you cut them off from... Certainly the fishery resources, why would you cut them off from everybody?
Because in the long-term situation with an uncertain future, it makes sense to do so.
All right, Paul.
I see no logical basis for that. But anyway, thank you for the
comment.
I thought
that was pretty logical, Paul.
Okay. We're going to leave it. I mean, clearly people are falling on one side or the other of this and why we're having the conversation and wondering if there really can be a place where there can be a meeting of the minds enough to be able to have both sides emerge a little happier. Is there a compromise position that you think might be in the offing if it's not what Senator Schatz has put forth?
Well, from our perspective, what Senator Schatz has put forth has no compromise in it whatsoever for our fishery.
You. Yeah, but is there something more that you would think that would have to be there so that people would be very clear that if that's not there, you're not going to be there either?
We would certainly appreciate an opportunity to have a conversation with Senator Schatz and others and try to develop some kind of positions that do take into account, once again, the value of the fishery to the state of Hawaii. And as William points out, these fish belong to everybody. And so the longline fishery, for example, is the major supplier of fresh seafood to the people of the state of Hawaii, as well as some to the mainland and a very small percentage to overseas markets. So we do think that it's important that we have access, and I would like to have a conversation that had some meaningful discussion that actually talked about real science, much less than advocacy science.
I would
echo that, but in reverse.
And that seems to be exactly the part where we're at, almost, you know, at a standoff, because of the fact that each of you looks at the others as being advocacy of science versus real science, and the fact that there just doesn't seem to be a place that would it be inclusive.
So,
when we say that it belongs to everybody, his point is, well, hey, we're part of the everybody.
Well, so the science that the Science Center puts out oftentimes is very specific studies looking at a very specific outcome. Whereas I think the science that we're referring to, given the fact that we know a lot more about climate change and we know a lot more about resiliency in large marine protected areas, they're two different sets of science. And the result is, you know, you have a more sort of long-term holistic approach like we're putting forward. And the, you know, the science center here is coming to conclusions about specific questions asked about certain conditions. That's the difference in some of the science that we have.
Okay, we're going to move on just in the interest of time and get some more of the callers in who would like to be talking to all of us. Tony calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Tony, and thanks very much for your patience.
Can you hear me okay?
We can, beautifully.
Okay, I'm getting a little bit of mixed trouble with the phone, but anyway, I hope you can hear me. My question, or really a comment toward Mr. Isla, is I heard that Mr. Isla mentioned on the air a little while ago that it was the Hawaiians that made the first ask to President Obama. However, I heard previously that Mr. Isla himself revealed off the air that it was Senator Schatz who made the first ask to him with this idea of the letter. So it sort of brings me to think that someone else is really driving this initiative. And then I keep hearing about the Pew Charitable Trusts and how they might be involved with this proposal. So who are they, and why are they doing this?
I can answer that question for you simply.
As far as Pew goes,
well,
which part of it do you want to take first?
I think first let's clarify that there was no off-air statement about Senator Schatz.
Because I'm curious, Tony, where you heard that.
I heard it off the record by a colleague of mine who claimed that Mr. Isla himself said that it was Senator Schatz who approached him with this idea.
Yeah, okay, we heard that part. So this is hearsay.
Yeah.
So did this happen?
Well, no. The correct sequence of the approach to the president, actually, we've never had any direct communication with the president. The request went to the president via a letter that was sent. And then follow-up discussions with the Office of Environmental Quality. And so the President's Office of Environmental Quality, Christine, and her last name escapes me right now, I was at an ocean conference in October in Chile where I had the opportunity to meet with her as she was waiting for her elevator and her car to come. And I approached her and said, "Hi, my name is William Isla. I'm from the state of Hawaii. I'm a resident, been involved in Papahanaumoku Akea. Would the president consider," and this is exactly what I said, "would the president consider an expansion of Papahanaumoku Akea, and would he consider making that statement at the World Conservation Congress?"
So it was your idea?
It was my idea, along with several other Native Hawaiians. You are well aware of who signed the letter that eventually went to the president.
Yeah, but where did the idea come from? What was the...
He's asking for the genesis of the idea.
The genesis. That's the word I was looking for.
Okay, so I think this will be the second time that I'm saying it. It came because of an opportunity to speak for probably about 5 minutes with the person who's in charge of the Office of Environmental Quality, asking, hey, would, one, he consider expanding, and two, at the time, more importantly, would that be enough to get him to come to the World Conservation Congress to attend to make an announcement? And so that's the genesis. And her response was, well, we'll think about it. Write us a letter. And so I came back to Hawaii, talked to some other Native Hawaiians, six of which signed the letter along with me. And that's how this process began. Now, Pew, because...
Now, let's talk a little bit about
sure.
Pew, because Pew... they've got the Global Ocean Legacy Project and others, but they've also been keeping track of how many square miles of ocean protected, you want to call it land, but or protected ocean there have been. And by their reckoning, 2015 was a pretty good year that over 1 million square miles were protected last year, which seems to bring up not only are they charting this, but also is this sort of a wave of protection that's moving through that might encompass what we see happening with Papahānaumokuākea in part.
Well, I think the United Nations, or one of the branches of the United Nations, has made it a policy that, you know, we've done a lot in protecting terrestrial lands and life on terrestrial lands. We should take a look at, you know, some percentage of protection of the ocean. So they threw that out there that it's somewhere around 30%. Going back to the question about Pew and their involvement, I've worked with them in the past, supporting other efforts to protect large marine areas around the rest of the world. So it was a natural ally for myself and the Native Hawaiians who supported this process to ask Pew, hey, can you help us out on this process? Because you have resources.
By the way, your encounter at the elevator sort of makes the case for why you need to always have a good elevator speech.
And you need to be ready for opportunity.
Hopefully when that happens, we've got several people who would like to take the opportunity to talk to both of you. We're going to go now to, let's see, who do we have here? We've got Charlemagne calling us from Kauai. Welcome to Town Square.
It's Shiloh Moon.
Sorry and, about that. I'm only repeating what they told me. My apologies.
Okay. I was going to ask about Pew, but now I'm going to change my question. Could I ask Sean a question?
Of course.
I'm not. Could Sean explain how the quota system works in the Pacific Ocean? Like, because there's a lot of people talking about quotas, and I don't really think a lot of people understand it.
Sure. Thanks.
It's pretty broad.
Charlotte. Yeah, it is. It is broad. And it's a very political process, as you might imagine, when you have 28 countries sitting in a room trying to discuss resources. It really does come down to the economics and money. The way it works for the Hawaii longline fishery is that we're managed through the Western Pacific Region Management Council and Department of Commerce here, and we are also participants through the U.S. delegation in international meetings. And so in our case, there is a quota on Big Eye tuna for the Hawaii longline fishery, and that quota is, I would make the argument it's somewhat arbitrary in the way it's established, but more importantly, it's very inconsistent in the way it's administered internationally. So the Hawaii longline fishery has a Big Eye quota only, not other species, and which is our primary species. And then there is an opportunity for us to participate with U.S. Pacific Island territories, that being American Samoa, Guam, and the Commonwealth of Northern Marianas, to share some of their allocated quota that they no longer use. And in exchange for that, they are provided some economic assistance that actually enhances their marine conservation plan. So it's a very, it's not a somebody writing a check to somebody in Guam, for example. It's a plan that's actually administered through the Fishery Council and NOAA. And so, and it's very specific to what that money can be used for. So, it's very complicated, as you might imagine. I could probably spend 3 or 4 days and try and explain it, and you still wouldn't get it. But that's how it works, and that's what we operate under. And it is an international water, so it's not in U.S. domestic waters. It's in both U.S. domestic waters and international or high seas waters. And, of course, one of the things that's important to note is when we're outside of the U.S. exclusive economic zone, we're fishing side by side with fleets from China, Taiwan, Korea, Japan, and others. So,
wow.
So that's one of the things that's important to us in continuing to have access to the U.S. exclusive economic zone is just that. It was set aside by the Magnuson-Stevens Act to help U.S. fishers have the chance to fish within U.S. waters without having to compete on an international scale on a day-to-day basis.
Thanks very much for the question. I think William Isla wants to add something to that, too.
I do. I find it amazing that, Sean refers to that process as sort of arbitrary when, in fact, it is based on the best international science that is available. So that's something that I just had to say. In addition, you know, I personally am not an international scientist, but anytime that you take a quota that was set for an area and you buy quota from so the Western Pacific, but you continue to fish the Central North Pacific, I scientifically that may be okay, but intuitively it just doesn't seem very appropriate as a sustainable scientific method.
We're going to take a few more callers. We're coming up to almost 6 o'clock. If you want to join the conversation, do it quickly, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Looking at the proposed expansion of Papahānaumokuakea and what may happen from this point forward. Very different points of view for various different reasons. And if you have something to add to this conversation, you're welcome to join it. Going to go now and talk to Kimo calling us from Wailea. Are you there?
Hello?
Are you there? Hi there.
Yes, hello. Hello, Sean and Bill.
Aloha.
Bill, this is Kimo Lannan. And
hello.
I know you from before and respect your work all the time. You know, we all know that the ancient Hawaiians were incredible stewards of the land and the ocean. And when there was a problem, the kapu system was initiated and people respected it and, you know, waited for stocks to return. And every day we read about fisheries disappearing all over the world. It seems to me that this is kind of a no-brainer that, you know, when things go, you know, you get less, then you just stop or you slow it down. And I don't think 8% is restrictive at all, especially for our children and grandchildren. So it's not much a question as a comment. And thank you for your good work, Bill.
All right. Thank you for calling.
So, you know, I'm glad that he brought up the kapu system because oftentimes people will look at the, you know, traditional methods of management from a very a very simplistic view in terms of sort of pigeonholing the practices. And so I'm sure if my kupuna had the knowledge that I have now about climate change, you know, for example, There's pretty good much science that says where I live on in Waianae that in the next 30 years there's going to be 30% less rain. So now that I am aware of that, I have a duty to my children to enact or to implement things to try to protect them as much as possible. Our kupuna, of course, did not have, you know, the knowledge that the world's ice poles are melting and these changes are occurring as quickly as they are. So I, in conjunction with, you know, the comment that was just made, just said, let's just be a little bit more cautious. The longliners, yes, indeed, maybe 5%, maybe 8% of the fish in that area is no longer available. But the fishing actually in the North Central Pacific and the Eastern Pacific is just as good. So, you know, if you give up a little bit, that's where I think we have
the biggest disagreement.
A disagreement. In our view, it's giving up a little bit. In their view, it's giving up a lot. And, you know, we're going to advocate for our sides. And that's, you know, the president is going to decide.
Well, and that's sort of the bottom line of it, because at this point, it's very much in his hands and we'll see what
Correct.
Happens. But as we're talking about how it may be affecting those of us here, we're going to continue with our conversation and bring Ron into it from Hawaii Kai. Aloha, Ron. Welcome to Town Square.
Thank you. Aloha all. Aloha. I don't know exactly who this question goes to, but it's an interesting follow-on to the kapu thought. If we are to expand and prohibit fishing, what measures do
Ron,
we have
Ron, to Ron, support? Ron, can I stop you for a second? We're having a really difficult time listening to you. If you could please make sure you're speaking right into the mouthpiece, that would make it a lot easier for both Sean and for William and for me and all of us to hear what you have to say. Thanks.
Okay, is this any better?
Oh, so much better.
Okay, thank you. Aloha all. This is an interesting follow-on to the kapu statement. If the expansion and the no fishing proceeds forward and isn't in fact accomplished, what steps or who is going to be responsible for enforcement? I'm very concerned that
even if it's a nominal number of 5 or 8% or whatever the number is, I'm very concerned that illegal fishing will take over, and the expectation that we will have fish for our children and grandchildren and down for generations to come may not, in fact, occur without strong enforcement. So I throw that on the table, and I don't know who can respond to that. Thank you.
Sean, you want to take a crack
at it?
Well,
yeah, thanks for the question. There's a couple of things going on. In the case of the U.S. fishery, the fleet is monitored 100% of the time wherever they go, and they're monitored electronically. So there's a dark room down at the federal building that the Coast Guard maintains, and they are actually tracking every boat in the Hawaii fleet. So we know where they are all the time. And that's been in effect since 1994. Actually, Hawaii was the pilot program for that. So Big Brother is always watching the U.S. fleet. We've always participated with the U.S. fleet when we see encroachments of foreign fleets within U.S. jurisdictional areas. And as these U.S. Jurisdictional areas get smaller and smaller, the resources required to monitor these areas, really the federal government doesn't have. And so you're right in being concerned about enforcement. And if the U.S. fleet isn't there, that's one less opportunity for enforcement. One thing I would like to point out that kind of tails into this is that since 2008 or so, there's been a ever increasing amount of Antiquities Act actions that have removed more and more areas, U.S. jurisdictional areas, from access by U.S. boats. 140,000 miles in 2008, not 65,000 miles in 2009, 308,000 square miles in 14, and now we're talking about an additional 500,000 square miles that won't have access. The U.S. won't have access to help with that enforcement question. So I hope that gives you a little perspective from my idea.
Sure, and you know, it's the enforcement, of course, is helped by the local long lane fleet. We have the U.S. Coast Guard that flies missions. We have the U.S. Navy that has work out there, and I'm sure that they report everything that they see. The vessel monitoring system that Sean referred to is a great system, and initially it was a small boat fisherman that pushed that because of infractions of the area closures and because of fishing within that marine protected area up in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. So it is very good because there have been violations and cases made because of that. It's something that should be pushed, and I would be happy to help push for all the international fisheries. With regards to pushing for or benefiting from any violations within the U.S. EEZ, the Western Pacific Fishery Management Council is actually the benefactor of anyone caught fishing in the U.S. EEZ. So they have a strong interest in making sure that enforcement occurs.
In the interest of time, we're going to have to let it go at that, but I want to thank both of you for being willing to come in and talk with all of us about this. Sean Martin, thank you for being here, and to William Isla, thank you very much for coming in. We'll have to have another discussion because there were callers who had questions for you. We couldn't get them in. We'll do it next time. And thanks very much to all of you for joining us tonight on Town Square. I'll see you tomorrow morning right back here at 8 o'clock for the conversation. Meanwhile, have a good evening. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Aloha.